Good evening, everyone. It's really nice to have you all here. There may be a few stragglers who come in, and we will graciously welcome them, but we're going to get started because we have a lot to discuss this evening. So, on behalf of the American University in Cairo, welcome to what we hope will be a spirited discussion about radical Islam and coverage of it in the Western press. As AUC President David Arnold has said, AUC is a unique bridge between the West and the Arab world, a world-class university in the heart of the Middle East. And it is, as such, at least in my personal opinion, terribly important. It provides the West with a better perspective on the East of the Middle East, but it also gives the Arab world greater exposure to American culture, education, and expertise. So what is the reason for tonight's forum? Well, very simply, it is because cultural perceptions in the U.S. and the Arab world of each other are being shaped right now largely by the media. With AUC's unique position between the two worlds, we see it as our responsibility to help correct misperceptions, or at the very least, shed new light on both sides. One way in which we hope to clarify perceptions is through tonight's discussion. But also on a day-to-day basis, we are training professional journalists at AUC's Adham Center. And by training Middle East journalists there, as well as Western journalists, we aim to send professionals out into the media who have a broad cross-cultural frame of reference. In fact, I think everyone here on this panel tonight has had some involvement with the Adham Center. So with that, I'd like to make the introductions. Larry Pintek, immediately to my left, is currently the director of the Adham Center for Electronic Journalism at AUC. He is a veteran of this business for over 30 years, and many of you probably have seen his reports over the years, either on CBS when he was Middle East correspondent or on ABC. But perhaps you've also read his very provocative, interesting book called Reflections Through a Bloodshot Lens. I'm not shilling for Larry in any way when I say it is a terrific book, and if you haven't read it, it's really illuminating. Abdullah Schleifer, on the far end, is the founder and former director of the Adham Center, as well as professor emeritus at AUC of journalism and mass journalism. Currently, he is Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya TV. He was a correspondent for the radio and producer for NBC News for many years and often appears as a guest on numerous other networks. You may also have seen him in the rather interesting documentary about Al Jazeera called Control Room. I'm hearing some mm-hmms. It was a great film. Amona El-Tahawi in the middle is a New York-based journalist whose op-eds appear in both the U.S. and the Arab press, everything from the Washington Post to Al-Sharq Al-Awsat. She often appears on the major news networks both here in the United States and in Britain. Before moving to New York, she was a correspondent for Reuters. Mona is also an AUC grad, having earned her BA and MA there. Myself, I served as an anchor and correspondent for NBC News and then Fox News Channel for over 15 years, specializing in the Middle East. I was also a Fulbright Scholar of Middle East Affairs based at AUC in Cairo. I'm currently on maternity leave, though. With that, I'd like to begin our discussion. Our topic is, as you all saw in your invitations, whether the Western media accurately portray radical Islam in their coverage. To get things started, it's probably helpful to agree first on a definition of radical Islam, since many people here may have differing ideas of what that phrase may be. So for argument's sake, let's settle on the definition that Larry Pintek uses in the preface to his book, Reflections in a Bloodshot Lens. And I'm condensing it, Larry, so if I am missing something, please correct me.
I'm not sure I remember what I wrote. <That's so. laughs>
We're all suffering from that disease. Radical Islam, essentially, as Larry would phrase it, is the ideology that follows or endorses violence as a means to an end. Now, to be clear, not all Islamic fundamentalists are necessarily radicals or militants. The key distinction is a willingness to advocate violence as a means of advancing an Islamist agenda. With that, on to our question. Do the Western media accurately portray radical Islam? Just to give you a sense of the structure of this evening, we're going to turn first to our panelists, each of whom will give an opening statement. We'll have some discussion among our panelists, and then, after a portion of time, I'll come out into the audience and do the Oprah thing. And we'll have a vigorous Q&A And so I hope all of you, as you listen to what our panelists are saying, are thinking of comments that you'd like to add as well. So with that, I'd like to begin with Mona.
Thanks for coming out. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I graduated many years ago, and I have very fond memories of AUC, so it's a great pleasure to be sitting here beside, in the middle between two professors of my old haunt, the TV Center. I just returned from a trip to Denmark, where many of you know a huge controversy started. Well, it didn't start in Denmark, but because of the cartoons published in Denmark, the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. And my trip to Denmark helped me realize what the problem is with the Western media and Islam in general, which will then lead me to the problems with or the accuracy or lack thereof in portrayal of radical Islam. So when I was there, I spoke to many, many Danes, Muslims and non-Muslim, and it quickly became apparent that for the Danish media, particularly their kind of the biggest public broadcaster anyway, The answer to this huge controversy that broke out over the cartoons was to basically just find a Muslim woman wearing a headscarf and put her on television. It was that simple. And I asked a journalist who co-hosts a show with her. It's called Adam and Asma. And I asked Adam, you know, did you find Asma because she's a qualified journalist who knows what she's doing, and you wanted to introduce that voice into this public broadcasting channel? Or did you just find a woman who's wearing a headscarf? And he basically said, we just found a woman who's wearing a headscarf. So you have this one image of a Muslim woman. Now, obviously, many Muslim women do wear headscarves, but many of us don't, like myself. But this is one way that you see Islam portrayed in the Western media. Women wearing headscarves, people on television kind of proclaiming these platitudes about Islam is peace, Islam means this, Islam means that. And on the flip side, you have, you know, what the British press used to call Captain Hook, Abu Hamza al-Masri, who for the longest time was the face of British Islam in the UK. Now, when he was arrested because the US administration wanted to deport him to the US on terrorism charges, you know, whether I agreed with his arrest and detention and now conviction in Britain or not, it was a huge relief to have him off the street. Because every time they wanted a Muslim to come on, they would have this man who has a hook for a hand and one eye, because he was injured in the war in Afghanistan. And how can you compete with Captain Hook, you know? So these are the two images of Islam that I'm talking about, Captain Hook and Asma with the headscarf. So and this really became apparent in post 9/11, you know, Western media, because there was no context for radical Islam. I mean, I was a journalist, as Linda mentioned, with Reuters News Agency in Cairo and then Jerusalem. And we covered in the Cairo Bureau. I mean, I joined the Cairo Bureau just as a militant movement was militant war was being waged against the Egyptian government in the 1990s, and you know, they basically, it was the predecessor to everything you're seeing now. Al Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri was head of Islamic Jihad. You had another group called Al-Jamaa al-Islamiyya. You had, you know, the roots of what we're seeing now, but many of those roots were completely absent, or the Western media was unaware of them. So this idea that radical Islam posed a threat to Muslims rather than just the West was completely absent when 9/11 happened. So when 9/11 happened, you had this idea that, oh my God, the world has changed. It's never going to be the same again. Whereas these kind of attacks were happening in Algeria, in Egypt, in many, many countries. There was no context for that. And, into the fray stepped Osama bin Laden with his version of Islam, and without that context and with that Captain Hook and Asma kind of dichotomy, Osama bin Laden's, you know, sayings and speeches became what Islam is. Anything he said was taken to be the agenda against which the rest of us had to basically argue. Now, I speak today as a commentator. I no longer cover news. So I've been kind of on both sides of it, if you like. I covered news in Egypt up until I came to the US, but I write opinion pieces now, and it's incredibly hard to get the kind of Muslim voice in the Western media that is not Asma and that is not Captain Hook. And, if anything, I find, because I want to keep this brief so that we do go on to questions. Having said all that, I do find some optimism. I'm kind of optimistic over efforts by the European Union lately to change the language that the Western media uses so that it's not just Asma and Captain Hook. Now, some of you may have heard that the European Union is working on a new lexicon that will change words like radical Islam or Islamic terrorism, and it will basically govern the way that they handle any language that has to do with terrorism committed by Muslims. So that instead of saying radical Islam, you would say radical Muslims. So that it's not the religion itself as a whole that is maligned, but the people who've hijacked the religion. And it's words like jihad, and as I mentioned, Osama bin Laden's agenda has become the template against which the rest of us have to basically fight. So words like jihad will be given a much more nuanced meaning, so that they don't just mean a violent kind of holy war. For many of us, jihad doesn't mean that. And another point, something else beyond moving beyond the European Union and its search for a new lexicon would be, and this is something that I've talked to many of my colleagues in the Western media about, introducing a different kind of Muslim voice that doesn't fall into the Asma and Captain Hook dichotomy. Now, next week in New York, an organization called the Auburn Media is launching a speakers bureau. And I'm kind of plugging them here because I'm one of the speakers on the bureau. But what they're doing is they're introducing what they call responsible religious voices from all different faith backgrounds and promoting them to the media, so that you're not just getting the same old voice. Now, here in the United States, for example, when I arrived in 2000, the most consistent voice on American television were organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations or the Islamic Society of North America, which are quite conservative and do not represent me and do not represent, you know, the 8 to 10 million Muslims in the U.S. So this Auburn Media Speakers Bureau is trying to change that, getting a liberal Muslim voice out there, getting a Muslim on television, you know, so that when you turn the television on, you go, that's a Muslim. I mean, the first time I was on American television, I was on Fox News on the O'Reilly Factor, and people writing emails to me saying, are you sure you're a Muslim? Where's your headgear? So it's challenging that kind of idea of what a Muslim is, that I can be a Muslim, I can have these ideas, and I can go out there and not have to constantly fight against Osama bin Laden's agenda. And more importantly, for the Western media and for those of us who do live in the West, it's establishing that idea, the idea that Muslims are over here too. Besides Asma and Captain Hook, you're always seeing Muslims burning things, Muslims burning flags, Muslims burning embassies. Fine, they exist, but there are Muslims over here too. And the Muslims over here rarely get a voice unless they belong to that conservative kind of Islam that falls into the Islam is peace, Islam means jihad, Islam, etc., etc. So I think, you know, combining those two things, the EU effort to change language and introducing those liberal voices, I'm hoping we'll see some kind of change and a more nuanced approach in the Western media towards the coverage of Islam in general, but particularly of radical Islam, and kind of giving it the size that it deserves, which is not that large. Thank you.
Larry, can I ask you to go next?
Sure. Not long ago, at the height of the Muhammad cartoon controversy, there was another cartoon in a Western newspaper, and it was while the embassies were being burned in Beirut and attacked in Damascus, and it showed a group of Muslims fight in the street attacking the embassy with flames behind them, and one guy says to the other, sure, now some Western cartoonist is going to make us look bad. Islam has always been its own worst enemy, exacerbated by the fact that we in the media, and I'll put on my reporter hat, by definition report superficially, particularly when it comes to television. When you're trying to explain the Middle East in a minute 15, you tend to fall back on stereotypes, cliches, simplistic answers. The vast middle ground in Islam has been silenced. Silenced in the West, and for the most part silenced in the Arab world as well. The focus has been on the harsh rhetoric. The focus has been on the extreme images. But again, at times, Islam has been its own worst enemy. When I and some of the folks in the Peanut Gallery were covering Beirut in the 80s, there was a group called Islamic Jihad. Well, we didn't have time in our reporting to explain that these people don't really represent the Muslim mainstream, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They called themselves Islamic Jihad. That's what we had to call them. That was their name. So there is that. That set up what happened after 9/11, where the media on both sides were weaponized, became weapons of war. The American media became extremely jingoistic. The Arab media became extremely defensive. And so we saw two completely different versions of the same reality. We framed things differently. We couched things differently. And you come right down to the core definition of what is terrorism. U.S. government has a dozen different definitions of what terrorism is. Each department and agency has their own. But they share one thing in common. All of those definitions say terrorism is something carried out by non-governmental entities. By definition, a government can't carry out an act of terrorism. That's our perception. Clearly, if you go to the Arab world or the broader non-Arab Muslim world, there is a very different perception. I mean, just today, Congressman Murtha had a news conference talking about this incident in Iraq a year ago where between 15 and 30 people were killed, and he said, the evidence is this was cold-blooded murder on the part of the U.S. military. This is an American senator, a congressman saying this. The perception in the Arab world is obviously that much of what we do, much of what Israel does, and the perception is we're intrinsically linked, is terrorism. And so that shapes how the Arab media covers it. It shapes how we cover it. We see things completely differently. The media has allowed itself to become a weapon of war, which is in part the reason that reporters are being so targeted in Iraq these days. And from the perspective of Al-Qaeda and radical Islam, the media is emphatically a weapon of war. Rami Khoury, who's a friend of most of us up here, is an editor-at-large at the Daily Star, came and talked to one of my classes a couple of weeks ago, and he said that the media is the only place where the Arabs are fighting the West to a standstill. And it's very true. 6 months ago, Zahiri, the right-hand man to bin Laden, had issued another video. And in it, he said that more than half the battle is taking place in the battlefield of the media. We are in a media race for hearts and minds. They know it, we know it, and that shapes coverage. With that, I'll throw it to Abdullah.
Well, I think part of the problem, and Muna has touched on that, is that the very phrase radical Islam is problematic. There's Islam, and there are Muslims. A radical Muslim, could be anything. We know what we're talking about. We're talking about terrorism, basically. We're talking about Muslims who have chosen to practice terrorism, which, for me, whether it's by a government or not by a government, means the killing of unarmed combatants, of civilians, men, women, and children. Anywhere, any place, not just the Arab world, not just America, but also a pizza parlor in Tel Aviv. Now, I think some of the problems in dealing with the press, and by the way, I think much of the problem in terms of the American press is not so much in the reporting as in the commentaries. I mean, some of the really outrageous commentaries that appear, particularly in conservative publications. I read the Washington Times all the time to balance out the Washington Post. And between the two of them, maybe I have a vague idea what's happening. And it's appalling, the sort of thing you read by columnists, more so than the reporting, because it's very interesting. And a lot of the reporting, if only because of the shock of Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, you're getting an approach to Muslims and to Islam that is not one that fits the curious parallel. What is the curious parallel I'm suggesting, as Larry suggested? And that is, first of all, I have used a phrase which I didn't invent, and the press, Western media didn't invent. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood in Europe in the 70s invented it when I was studying Islamic political thought at AUB. And I remember, and that was the phrase Islamist. And I thought there was a great integrity to that phrase, Islamist. I mean, it's one of the few things I'll give the Muslim Brotherhood credit for. Because basically, what they were acknowledging quite proudly is that in their perception, Islam was an ideology. And I said last April, if I thought Islam were an ideology, I'd be a Buddhist. I took Islam in flight from ideology, as did many of my generation of Westerners who took Islam. We were in flight from ideology. We're in flight from an instrumentalism that could turn two into two into five or six or seven, depending on the needs of the revolution. And so the point is that basically we're looking at a phenomena, and that's why Islamist is very good. Islamist, Leninist, socialist, Marxist, you know, whatever. It's an ist, an ideology. It's where religion, and part of this is a historic problem, which it's very difficult for Western journalists to get a handle on unless they spend time in the region, but in which when a religion is emptied of its spiritual or mystical core, because the spiritual mystical core animates all living religions. In other words, I would argue that when religion was a really powerful dominant force in Europe, at the core of it were the monastic orders, you know, spiritual mystical experience. And that's what made it alive, not formalistic and legalistic, whatever. And certainly that's true with Islam. And to the degree that over the last 100 years, the inner mystical spiritual core of Islam became very unfashionable. And in fact, it was the one thing that united the fundamentalists, the modernists, the secularists. They all were put off by the mystical core of Islam. There's a vacuum. And into that vacuum came ideology. And so radical ideology, and it's not a coincidence, and I pointed this out one day when I was strolling with Ayman Zawahiri. It's not, and he was so proud of the fact, this is, you know, back in the 70s, the first time I met him. And he was so proud of the fact that the top campuses of Cairo University, right, academically, it's sort of like City College in the 30s, you know, it was a great outfit academically, but it also fostered the Central Committee of the American Communist Party. Now, not to mention the Trotskyists, who went on to greater fame, as we're all experiencing now. So he pointed out with great pride that it was the School of Engineering and the School of Medicine, you know, where you really had kids hustling, like, from Tanta instead of the Lower East Side, but they had good grades, they got in there, that these were the citadels of the Islamist movement, that their movement had just taken that. And I said to him, rather mischievously, I was here in 65 briefly, weren't these same faculties a stronghold of the Marxist left? And he said, yeah. And I said, wait a minute. And isn't Tanta University, which is really the university now, and Assyut, I said, isn't that really your stronghold? Which it was. And in fact, as we know, when Sadat was assassinated, the rebellion broke out. The one place where people took to the streets with guns was in Assyut. I said, I remember in 65, we called it the Red University, which suggests that revolutionary ideology can move from left to right. I mean, in Europe, we knew it. It was called Leninism. And the Leninism of the left was Marxist, and the Leninism of the right was fascist. And I would argue that Islamism in its radical form is a form of clerical fascism. But that doesn't mean every Islamist is into violence. I mean, look at Marxism. Marxism was not homogeneic. It spanned everything from Leninists to social democrats, many of whom became the first victims of communism in turn. It's a very complex thing. But I think that's the starting point. That this whole idea that there is a politicized and overly politicized Islam, which is now emptied of spiritual and turned into an idea, that we're dealing with an ideology, not a religion. Not a religion. And that's a point that certainly the right-wing commentators miss, and some journalists who want to be fair and want to be sympathetic. But they too confuse Islamism with Islam, whether that Islamism is violent or it's moderate. And you know, the other thing we have to say is terrorism. You know, the great answer after 9/11, when President Bush visited the mosque, clustered with some of the very people you were talking about, which is ironic, since some of them had interesting backgrounds, which related to terrorism. But anyway, The interesting thing is that at that time, some American Muslims say, hey, terrorism has nothing to do with Islam. Nothing to do with Islam. This is just a bunch of weirdo. All right. Well, the fact of life is that within a few years of the death of the Prophet, there was a significant heresy in Islam called the Kharijite movement, which was a movement that had all the principles that are in play today in Islamist terrorism, which was takfir, that if you disagree with someone, he doesn't share your doctrines, you could say he's an apostate and you can kill him and his wives and his children. And they also had the doctrine of, you know, that they could do this. They could do terrorism and they could base it on takfir. And this is precisely the doctrines and it was crushed. It took maybe 50, 60 years, but mainstream Islam crushed it. Because and the jurists recognized it for what it was. And again, nobody knows this, but there is a whole squad. I'd be a little hesitant before the liberals throw Sharia out, because for two reasons. One, what again, very few people realize is most of Sharia has nothing to do with public life or political life. It has to do with how we pray, how we fast, how we pay zakat. It has to do with the personal conduct of religion, like canon law in the Catholic Church. And the part of Sharia that is so controversial is really a secondary aspect, you know, the public, and always open to a more flexible interpretation. And the reason why I would hesitate to throw Sharia out is if you go to Azhar, instead of either an Al-Ihram correspondent, I don't want to make enemies of Al-Ihram, I think it's a great paper, but you know, go to either an Al-Ihram correspondent on one hand or an Islamist on the other, they're not going to tell you that one of the basic categories of Sharia is a thing called haraba, which is terrorism. And to kill people as terrorism in classical Sharia is considered worse than murder. Because murder very often has a personal reason. It's a personal crime. You know, you and I are fighting over some girl, you and I are fighting over something, you know, and but terrorism is impersonal, is simply selecting a group of civilians and killing them. And in classic Sharia, this was the worst crime. And it didn't matter who the terrorist killed, whether he killed a Muslim or a non-Muslim, it was punishment by death. And the very fact that this is ignored, now the Azharis know it and they'll say it. I was at a conference a year ago in Amman and that came out as a declaration. Haraba, the Council of Fiqh in America know it, but the press doesn't know that terrorism is one of the great crimes in Islam. So finally, and my last point, because I think I've been going on a bit, is that above all we should realize, and the press should realize, Islamists, extremists, Muslims, whatever you call, are not traditional Muslims. They are not traditional Muslims. And they certainly, and one of the interesting things is the sociology. I'm not talking necessarily about the leadership. I mean, came from a fairly religious family. But generally, the interesting thing is like the recruit, like Massawi, you know, it's very interesting to study his background. Invariably, they had limited, either little or no exposure to traditional Islam. The boys involved in the suicide attacks in England. And then there is sort of floating in a spiritual vacuum, you know, life is, I don't know what. And then they encounter these preachers of hatred, these people, these ideologists, just as you, people like that, dislocated. For instance, the Saudis, Saudi intelligence did an interesting study of the Saudis who were in 9/11. And almost all of them had been thrown out of their family because they were wastrels, didn't make their prayers, you know. I mean, they were socially disorderly types, you know, the sort of obviously recruiting ground for any revolutionary movement. We should bear this in mind. And this is a sort of thing that, to the degree the Western press can be conscious of these things, I think the reporting will get better. Thank you.